Hey, it's Chad and Christy. Welcome to another edition of our Theme Parks and Recs podcast dedicated to all things Walt Disney World, Universal Studios, Busch Gardens, all of those wonderful theme parks we have here in Florida, and other recreational activities in Tampa Bay and beyond. It's a very busy time over at Walt Disney World. They are having their International Festival of the Arts through February the 19th. We had the opportunity to talk to Mindy Johnson, one of the authors, a couple of weeks ago about the ladies of the ink and paint department that worked on all of those classic Disney movies that we love and cherish to this day. And the author that's going to be there this weekend, in the same right, the legacy that he is leaving is unreal. His name is Dave Bossert. He was the artistic director at Walt Disney World Animation Studios and has done visual effects on The Lion King, Aladdin, Beauty and the Beast, Little Mermaid, Pocahontas, Hercules, all of those Disney movies that are gems and that we and our kids love to watch. And we have the opportunity to get him on the phone right now. Want to start quickly, Dave, with a story that we experienced a couple of weeks ago when we were out in Los Angeles. We went to Walt's Barn, which anybody who's a Disney fan, I would suggest going to. We bumped into Floyd Norman, who, of course, was one of the animators who started back on Sleeping Beauty and has basically been a part of every single one of the movies to now. And I was so in awe. And he goes, I'm just an animator. I'm a nobody. And I was like, are you crazy?
Yeah.
I mean, are all animators that humble, or is that just Floyd?
Yeah, no, I generally think so. I mean, you know, because we're you know, in a sense, behind the scenes. And, you know, I had the opportunity to work on some really great movies I'm very proud of. You know, it's humbling when people get excited that you know, when they meet you and they hear you worked on Roger Rabbit or, you know, Beauty and the Beast or whatever. It's very humbling. And it's also very humbling to hear how these movies have touched people over the years.
Well, they've become things that people have grown up with and then they share with their families.
Exactly. And you know, I always point to The Lion King because of the loss of Mufasa, Simba's father. And after that movie released, you know, the studio received tons of letters from people all over the world who were touched by that. Kids who had lost a parent, and the movie helped them to get through it.
Wow.
And, you know, to this day, I get choked up over it sometimes.
The legacy and just, I didn't even think about that part of it. I mean, that truly is amazing. And
yeah.
I mean, not just Lion King for you, but I mean, looking at the movies that you have worked on throughout the years, Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin and Pocahontas. I mean, these are the gems and you have been a part of every one of them.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing when you start to look back at, you know, 30-some-odd years and the movies that you had the opportunity to work on. And, you know, there's just great stories and great memories. And each one of those films had challenges and, you know, just funny moments and things like that. So, you know, for me, it's just all these great memories.
Now, we also had a chance on a couple of different occasions, and I feel honored with this, too, to bump into Bob Gurr, you know, one of the original Imagineers.
Yeah.
And everything that he's been a part of at the theme parks. And I always, when I see him again, say, okay, Bob, I need another story. And he's always great about going, did I tell you the one about? And this last time it was the monorail. And, I mean, he's so full of the story. So I'm going to do the same thing to you then. Tell me a story.
My gosh, you know, there's just so many of them from over the years. You know, I had the great opportunity to work with Roy E. Disney on a number of projects and got to know him and became friends with him and traveled with him. So, you know, there's some pretty wild stories there of just, you know, he was such a down-to-earth guy that I remember not long ago, it was probably 10, 12, 15 years ago, I guess, I got invited to the opening of Mary Poppins, whenever that was, on Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And I happened to be talking with Roy, and I said, hey, are you going to the opening of Mary Poppins? He goes, oh, yeah. He goes, we're going to go. Are you going? I said, well, I got invited, and I wasn't sure if I was going to go. He goes, well, I'll give you a ride if you want.
Oh.
And it was on his private plane. And he offered that, like, hey, I've got my old station wagon. I'll swing by and pick you up.
Right.
And it was that sort of generosity, and he was just such a magnanimous individual. He never hesitated to you know, make offers like that, and it was wonderful. And he said, I can get you there, but you'll have to figure out how to get back because, you know, we're heading on to Europe after that, you know. So yeah. It was one of those kind of moments where, you know, when I've traveled with him, we went up to New York once, and when we were planning the trip, he says, well, I have an apartment in New York. Why don't you just stay at my place? And I said, okay, you know, and, you know, I took a bedroom down the hall.
Well, certainly through the years, we've heard so many stories about Walt and even his brother, Roy. But you've written a book about Roy E. Disney, Roy's son and Walt's nephew. Tell us a little bit about that.
He wasn't one to want to jump into the limelight a lot, but he was the guy that saved the Walt Disney Company not once but twice. And the company would not be what it is today if it wasn't for Roy E. And I wanted to write the book on him, really to give people the impression or sort of a sense of who Roy E. was as a human being, as a person, if they hadn't had the opportunity to meet him or know him. And so really it was a collection of stories that I put together, and I interviewed a few people and got some additional stories to round it all out. But it wasn't a tell-all type of book. It was really a book to, when people finished it, I wanted them to feel like they kind of knew him a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Was there, at any time when you were doing the research for this book, did he reveal a story about his father or about Walt that, I mean, and you've obviously been a part of the Walt Disney World Company for, you know, decades, but was there a story you heard that you had not heard before?
You know, yeah, I wrote this book after he had passed away, and so, you know, when I knew him, I used to hear stories from him all the time. I mean, he told a wonderful story of being sick in bed back in the 1930s, and Walt coming over to visit, you know, his mom and dad, and Walt came up to his bedroom and sat on the edge of his bed and told him about a movie he wanted to do that he was starting to develop, and he proceeded to tell him the whole story of Pinocchio.
Wow.
You know, and so it was those kinds of stories that, you know, he would convey to me, you know, whenever we sat around chatting. And we spent some time together, and we spent one-on-one time together. I mean, we had dinners together, and he was just really kind of a really down-to-earth person. I mean, that's what I usually tell people. One of the funny stories was I was meeting him in Hollywood one evening for dinner, and we were going to a small little restaurant that was in a house that had been converted to a restaurant, and I was standing outside waiting for him, and, you know, he, as down-to-earth as he was, he liked Ferraris and planes. And so I was expecting him to come tooling around the corner in a red Ferrari that he had, and I'm standing there waiting, and I see a red Mini convertible come whizzing around the corner, and I did a double take because he was behind the wheel. And I said, I almost didn't recognize you. I go, when did you get this? He goes, oh, I just got it like a week ago. He goes, the gas is killing me. You know, this was when gas was approaching $5 a gallon.
Right.
He goes, the gas is killing me on the Ferrari.
That's funny.
I just had to laugh because here was a guy that was a billionaire, and he's still conscious of the value of a dollar.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he ate at Taco Bell, and, you know, there's just really funny stories like that. You know, somebody had posted on social media that they saw Roy at a Taco Bell by Warner Brothers in the Toluca Lake Burbank area.
I know that Taco Bell very well.
Yeah.
We call it the Dirty Llama Taco Bell because we used to park in a space that had a Dirty Llama tattoo or a sticker on it.
Okay.
And unfortunately, it's no longer there.
Yeah. Exactly. But when it was there, Somebody spotted Roy eating there and had said, I saw Roy at Taco Bell, he was eating blah, blah, blah. You know, he mentioned a couple of items. And so somebody said to Roy, hey, Roy, we heard you were at Taco Bell and had X, Y, and Z. And he says, well, yeah, I was at Taco Bell, but that's not what I had. But you know, that was a fun book. But I'm going to be actually coming down to Orlando this weekend. I'm going to be at the Festival of the Arts at Epcot.
Yep.
And I'm going to be speaking about my latest book, Oswald the Lucky Rabbit, Search for the Lost Disney Cartoons. And I'm also going to be signing copies of The Art of Tennessee Loveless, the Mickey Mouse 10x10x10 Contemporary Pop Art Series. Boy, that is a mouthful of a title. But the Tennessee Loveless book is 100 paintings of Mickey Mouse, and this is the 90th anniversary this year of Mickey Mouse.
Yeah.
100 paintings of Mickey Mouse by a pop artist who's colorblind.
Wow.
And it's a very fascinating story, and it was very interesting how that sort of dropped into my lap, because it was just totally by happenstance. And the Oswald book, well, I mean, we all know the story of Oswald. If it wasn't for Oswald, we wouldn't have a Mickey Mouse.
And you know what's interesting? We went to Disneyland when we were out in California in December, and we've been to the theme parks. I mean, we've been to both theme parks in Japan. We've been to Paris. Around the world, we're such Disney fanatics. So, you know, we've been in and out of Disneyland so many times, and I don't know that if I've ever stopped to take a picture with a character until we were leaving California Adventure Park, and there was Oswald. And I went, gotta have a picture, because I had never seen him out. I didn't even know that there was a character meet and greet with Oswald. But I know the history, and without an Oswald, there would have never been a Mickey Mouse. But what was it for you? I mean, obviously you're an animator, so you know the history, and you're enamored with that too. But was there something specifically about Oswald that spoke to you that made you want to write the book?
You know, again, a lot of these books that I've been involved with, that I've written, have been topics that really haven't been touched on. And there was no book on Oswald. And because of the fact that Walt never owned the rights to the character, and then he lost the contract to it, a lot of that information kind of scattered to the wind. And again, it was just the funniest thing. I was sitting in my office at Disney, and this is probably 2010, 2011, and I had just finished reading a little article online about a Lost Oswald cartoon that had surfaced that was going to be sold at auction, at a Hollywood memorabilia auction. And I thought, huh, that's kind of interesting. And just as soon as I finished reading that article, I heard a little chime of my email, and I look up, and there's an email coming in from a couple of executives at the studio, and they were forwarding an email from somebody who was inquiring about Oswald, and they had a question for me. And so I answered that question and said, oh, by the way, there's this Lost Oswald cartoon that just surfaced. We should probably try and buy it now that we have the original 26, the rights to the 26 that Walt created back from Universal. We should try and buy this. And they said, oh, that's a good idea. We'll put some money together for you and go buy that. And so I went and got Hungry Hobos, which had been lost. And surfaced. It had surfaced in a private archive in England.
Wow.
So I wound up purchasing that for the company, and we did a restoration on it. We had a great composer, Emmy-winning composer, Mark Waters, write a score for it. And so I thought to myself, well, if that one surfaced, I wonder if there's other lost cartoons, because half of the titles, when they got the rights back from Universal, half of them were missing. They were lost. There was no film prints on them. And I thought, well, if Hungry Hobos is, you know, surfaced, why don't we see if there's others? And so we hired a consultant named David Gerstein, who's based out of New York, and he's a good friend now. I didn't really know him very well back then, but he's turned into a good friend. And he really did a lot of detective work in doing dives into archives all over Europe. And we wound up finding five more titles.
Hmm.
So they originally had 13, now they have 19. There's still seven missing. And I'm even though I'm not at the company, I'm still looking for some of those lost titles because I think it's important to repatriate them. And it would be really cool for the 100th anniversary of the Disney company in 2023 to be able to have a complete record of those.
That would be amazing, and how great that you've had such an impact on getting the ball rolling and curating that for the Walt Disney Company and for all the fans.
Now, and you know something, in the process of looking for those, you know, I just started learning a lot more. I started going to the company archives. You know, we started finding stuff around the country, and then I just, you know, pitched the idea to publishing and said, you know, we should really put a book together on Oswald. And they said, yeah, we love that idea. Let's go do it. And so that's how the book came about. And it took about 2 years to do all of the research and write it and, you know, find all of the images that, again, were scattered to the wind. You know, we found posters at auction houses. There's a photograph in the book of Walt Disney that the Walt Disney Company doesn't have. It was a snapshot that some collector had, and we found it with him. And he sent me a JPEG of it. I sent it to the company photo library, and I said, hey, do you guys have a higher-res image of this? And they came back and said, Dave, we don't have a copy of this image.
Wow.
We've never seen this before. So there's that's a picture of Walt from about 1926 when he was making the Alice comedies.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just, you know, I always like to dive into things and learn and, you know, dig up material that people haven't seen before and just have a ball with it. And that's, some of these projects have really turned into dream projects for me.
You get to do something that millions of us would pay a lot of money to do, to go through the archives and be able to see everything. So you're very lucky. and I know you're coming back to Epcot this weekend, to the Festival of the Arts, to sign these books and to share these stories with everyone. It's also, we kind of consider it Old Home Week to welcome you back, because aside from your work doing the visual effects on so many of the Disney movies, you've worked on some of our favorite attractions as well, our family's favorite, Seven Dwarfs Mine Train, and you were a part of it, so we want to hear about that.
Yeah, is that awesome or what? I mean, that is such an awesome roller coaster, and I love the fact that they designed those cars so they're like free-swinging mining buckets,
yeah.
You know? That was a really fun project to work on, partly because it was groundbreaking with some new technology on the audio animatronics with the projected faces. And I really had a lot of fun working with the team at Walt Disney Imagineering. And we really slammed together a test, a proof of concept, to see that it could work, using a figure of Wendy from Peter Pan,
uh-huh,
that they had lying around at Imagineering, and they were able to, you know, sort of kludge together, you know, the projector, and wound up utilizing an existing piece of animation of Rapunzel from Tangled. And so we kind of slapped together a test as a proof of concept, and when we were done with the test, everybody looked at it and said, wow, this is going to work. It needs a little tweaking, but this is going to work. And so, you know, we went on this journey of creating the facial animation for the dwarves for those audio animatronics of the Seven Dwarves.
Wow!
And the entire team that put that attraction together, I mean, just did a spectacular job. It's just so beautiful.
You know what? We use Disney World and the Disney Company as a teaching tool for our kids all the time. Since they were little kids, we started out by teaching them the four keys to the kingdom, because we said, you know what, If you follow those four keys to the kingdom, you're probably going to do okay in life. But also when it comes to everything that the animators and the Imagineers and the entire team down to the cast members do, as far as everything is the details, the small details, it really is a great teaching tool for kids to say, you know, go back, rethink, how can you make this more of an experience? And our kids have kind of taken that and run with it in everything that they do in life.
Yeah, you know, and I am a firm believer of that. I mean, you know, everything you do in life, there's a story to tell. You have to figure out what is that story, you know. And I often, you know, talk out and about with people, and it doesn't matter what you're doing. You know, it's, you know, if you're an accountant and you have to do a presentation, what is the story of those numbers? You know, and you can make it dry or you can make it, you know, exciting. But there's that underlying story for everything. And that's the beauty of going into those parks, because they really, no matter where you go and what you look at, there's an underlying story to it.
Mm-hmm. So after Festival of the Arts,
yeah,
what is next for you, Dave?
Wow, you know, there's a lot going on. I'm actually in the midst of finishing up a book on the making of The Nightmare Before Christmas for next year.
Awesome.
I'm also working on a book about Kem Weber and his animation furniture designs for Disney. And Kem Weber was a mid-century architect, and he designed the Disney Studios in Burbank. And as part of that, he was part of this whole West Coast modernism movement of that time. And the philosophy was one of holistic design. So it wasn't just designing the building. It was designing the building and all the furnishings that went into the building. So wow. It was all cohesive. And nobody's really written anything about the animation furniture he designed for the Burbank studio. And so I actually was, this past Monday and Tuesday, I was in Santa Barbara because he had left his papers at the University of California at Santa Barbara. And I was doing a bit of a dive on all of his work that he did for Disney, and doing research. And so that's a book that's going to come out later this year. And I kind of refer to that as a monograph. It's a smaller project, a niche project, from the standpoint that, you know, it's very narrowly focused on the Kem Weber animation furniture.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, I am sitting, as I'm talking to you, I am sitting at a 1939 Kem Weber animation desk that the studio was kind enough to give me when I left.
Wow.
And that's where I do all my writing now.
How incredible.
Yeah, which is a lot of fun. So I've got more book projects coming out and more travels. I'll be doing a signing on the 18th here in Los Angeles at Walt's Barn. I've got an event at the end of March up in Sacramento. I'm going to be in London. I'm going to be in Italy in March. So I've got a little bit of travel and a whole bunch of writing to do.
What a life. What an adventure.
It has been. It has been. I feel very lucky every day. You know, it's been a wild ride, and now I get to write about a lot of it, which has been a lot of fun. So, I mean, just so many great films, too. You know, I have so many fond memories of Who Framed Roger Rabbit. I worked on that over in London.
Which is a lovely place.
Yes, it is.
Well, and our son is a huge fan of Land Before Time, and I know you worked on the original for that, too. So
I did work on Land Before Time. Boy, that was back in the day when I was just working on everything under the sun.
Mm-hmm.
It was so funny because, you know, the first gig I had at Disney when I first got hired in was on The Black Cauldron. And I really thought, wow, like, this is my first and last animated movie. And I thought for sure I was going to get laid off, because they wound up laying off about, I think they laid off 60% of the crew.
Wow.
At the end of Black Cauldron, because that was really a very transitional time.
It was.
When I was working on that picture, there was a battle for the Disney company, and we're talking back in the mid-80s, and there was a financier who felt like he could take over Disney and carve it up and sell the parks off and sell the film library off and stuff. And that's where Roy came in and saved the company. And in the process, brought in Michael Eisner and Frank Wells to run it. Mm-hmm. And the company just had this, meteoric growth after that. And, but those early years, the Black Cauldron and the Great Mouse Detective, I didn't know from one picture to the next whether I was going to have a job after I finished the picture. And so, for the first, I think, 4 or 5 films, I just worked as hard as I could. I did as much overtime as possible, and I saved as much money figuring, okay, this is it. I'm going to get laid off at the end of this picture. And after about 5 pictures, I kind of got comfortable in thinking, I guess they're gonna hold on to me. And, I had a wild 3-plus decade run. So it was good.
Well, what would you say to any young person that wants to get involved in either animation or special effects or design? Because I know our son, he's always wanted to be an Imagineer. He thinks that he might want to go in the design aspect. What would your suggestion be as far as school or training?
I'm of the mind that learning is a lifelong endeavor. In fact, I will tell you, even though I have a number of books published, I'm in the writer's program at UCLA, and I've been taking classes there at night. And I've been going to school, taking classes every year since I graduated from college. So 30 plus years I have been taking classes every single year someplace, UCLA, specialty schools, whatnot. I go up to Maine every summer to a boat building school, and people sit there and scratch their head like, why are you going to a boat building school? Because I take different classes, and it allows me to do something that I've never done before, learn something new, and also look at things differently. And all of that experience that you get just keeps, it keeps your mind moving. It keeps you fresh. It keeps you thinking of, what it is you can and, can do differently and improve something. So for me, it's really about, the advice I give to people is go get trained. Go to school. If you want to be a designer, find out what great design schools are nearby or where you can go, what you can apply for, and go to those schools. I went out to Cal Arts from New York. I grew up on Long Island in New York, and I went out to Cal Arts. I think it was 19, 20 years old when I went to Cal Arts, and I didn't know a soul west of the Mississippi. I had no relatives. I didn't know anybody out here, and I just packed up a Volkswagen Beetle and drove cross country and went to Cal Arts. And,
wow!
I just feel like there's always a sense of fear that people get. Sometimes people are afraid, and you got to overcome that. You got to just go for it, and you have to have that burning desire in your belly that you want to do something. If you want it bad enough, you will go do it. And it's not going to be an easy road. And that's something I have to tell you guys, and I, if you got a moment, I see this on a regular basis. In some of the writing classes I've been in at UCLA, I see people come in, and after 2 or 3 classes, they never show up again.
Mm-hmm.
Because they realize it's hard work.
Yeah.
Just because your mom or your girlfriend or your brother or a friend tells you, hey, you're a good writer, you should write a book, doesn't mean you're going to write a book, because it is hard work.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to realize that you got to do that hard work to sort of grab the brass ring at the end. You know, the book doesn't write itself. You have to really spend a lot of lonely time by yourself writing a book. And so, you know, it's so true with anything. If you want to be a great designer, you know, you've got to go and do those foundation classes, and you've got to put in the time and effort and really work at it. And I remember, you know, with animation years ago, I saw this frequently, especially when I was at Cal Arts. You'd see somebody struggling, but they were working so hard. And at some point, it's like a runner. You know, runner hits the wall, but then they break through. It's that kind of a thing. I've seen people struggle, and then all of a sudden they have that breakthrough, and they become a great animator. And that's because you really have to work at it. Mm-hmm. You know, Chuck Jones, the great Warner Brothers animator-director, had a saying he used to tell people when he went out to speak. He said, everybody's got 10,000 bad drawings in them, so get drawing.
There you go.
You know, and it's so true. You just have to keep working at it. And if you work at it long enough and hard enough and really put your heart into it, you will break through and you will do something.
That's awesome.
You know, and if you don't, then your heart wasn't in it.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of how I look at it, you know. And, you know, it's just life is a learning experience.
For sure. So if everybody wants to meet you and get a copy of your new book on Oswald the Lucky Rabbit, signed this weekend, International Festival of the Arts at Epcot, are you going to be there the whole weekend?
Yeah, I'm going to be there on Saturday. I'm going to be speaking at 11 a.m. It's in the Odyssey Showplace at Epcot.
Mm-hmm.
There's also going to be a pop-up bookstore where I'll be signing books afterwards. And then on Sunday at 1 o'clock, I think the Saturday event is a ticketed event.
Okay.
And the Sunday event is free.
Okay.
And so, if people are in the area, come on down. You guys are in Tampa, aren't you?
We are indeed, yes. Annual pass holders over at Walt Disney World.
That's fantastic. One of my favorite places over in the Tampa, St. Petersburg area is the Dolly Museum.
Uh-huh. Oh, yes.
And I've spoken over there with my Dolly and Disney Destino book.
A
number of times. It's a beautiful museum.
Yeah, there's some unique stories there between Salvador Dali and Walt Disney for sure.
Absolutely. I mean, we could talk all day long.
Absolutely. Well, we'll have to set something up again.
Yeah, absolutely. It was really pretty fantastic speaking with you guys.
Thank you. Same with us. It was a pleasure, and have fun this weekend. Hopefully we'll try to get over on Saturday to say hello in person.
I'd love it. I'd love to see you guys. It was great speaking with you, and hopefully I'll speak with you again real soon.
Sounds good. Take care, Dave.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.